I bet you make a lot of people unhappy.
Yeah, I don't know. I think maybe my writing kidding. Makes people uncomfortable, but I think on a daily basis, I get on pretty well with people sometimes.
Have you gotten any backlash for anything you've written?
Yeah, I got a couple of mean emails. I think one of my friends was very upset with me, but you know, I just had to explain to her that these are just facts. I'm just reporting this stuff, right? I'm not trying to like, can I swear on your podcast?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not trying to shit on you. I'm not trying to ruin your day or anything. This is just what the numbers indicate, and it is what it is. Right.
And it's fair. And like reporting statistics too is one thing. It doesn't mean that there aren't going to be outliers. So yeah. People don't have to particularly get offended. Right. Because it's like, no, on average, this is life.
Right.
This is what it looks like.
I'm sure you get the same as well, right? I'm sure you talk to groups of people and they're just not happy with what you have to say, but it's just, this is the reality in which we live, right? We can't go left or right.
Welcome to episode 146 of the Michaela Peterson Podcast. I'm Michaela Peterson. In this episode, I spoke with Vincent Harnum about modern dating, pickup artists, and some terrifying statistics on gender dynamics. Vincent is a data scientist and law enforcement consultant. He completed his PhD at Cambridge, where he currently teaches. I asked him several questions like, what do women want, Vincent? What do men want? Is a higher IQ beneficial for relationships? What are some other factors that affect relationships, like divorce being 50% more likely for women who out-earn their husbands? And what really is a simp? We also talked about the red pill nerds, the manosphere, risk-taking, OnlyFans, and geeks. Please subscribe if you enjoy this episode. Before we get started, this episode was brought to you by NordVPN. NordVPN hides your IP and lets you access forbidden parts of the internet. Want to buy nootropics from China? NordVPN. Kidding. Don't do that, probably. Listeners outside the US know how much bigger the Netflix catalog is here. Suckers, now I'm in America and this immigrant can access your Netflix. But while traveling, I still use NordVPN. You probably know NordVPN is the fastest VPN in the world. It doesn't buffer or crash like others I've used, but you may not know all the ways it can protect you too. Phishing sites or malware sites, for example, are only getting better. Even companies like Facebook, Twitch, or LinkedIn get hacked routinely. Those of you who've manually changed passwords for over a dozen accounts understand the pain. NordVPN works across all your devices to protect you from all those threats and more. They're hands down the best VPN in the game. If you haven't tried them already, now's the best time to start. Take advantage of my exclusive limited time offer today and see what full online protection really feels like. Grab your NordVPN deal today over at nordvpn.com/TMPP or use promo code TMPP, like the Michaela Peterson Podcast, for 61% off their premium plan and their anti-malware feature, all with NordVPN's 30-day money-back guarantee. nordvpn.com/TMPP or code TMPP. I hope you enjoy this episode.
Vincent Harnum, welcome to my podcast.
Hey, Michaela, thanks for having me. Really appreciate the invite.
This is going to be fun. It's nice seeing you again. I think the last time I saw you, I was in the UK.
Absolutely. It's been quite a while. That was November, if I remember correctly.
That was November.
Yeah, it was a great couple of events we put on here in Cambridge and across the UK. Your dad was fantastic.
Yeah, it was really fun. Okay, so before we get into things, can you give a brief background about who you are and what it is you do?
Sure. Well, I am a law enforcement consultant and a data scientist. I also teach at the University of Cambridge. You know, really honestly, I'm just a guy that likes numbers. I think that's probably the easiest way to put it. Aside from that, there's really nothing else. It's a guy that likes applying statistical and mathematical acumen to understand social phenomena.
Okay. How does law enforcement and data scientists, how do those two things intertwine? Law enforcement, what did you say?
A law enforcement consultant and a data scientist.
Yeah, okay.
So you'd have to imagine that there's a lot of crime data out there. A lot of police organizations have quite a bit of data that they need analyzed. And I have the ability to do so. So they would give me a data set or a specific problem that they want me to work on. And I would leverage a set of statistical models in order to provide an answer or give them some sort of leverage with the data. So in essence, it's them providing some data, me saying, well, these are the results that I found, and these are the policy implications of these findings.
Okay. Interesting. Wow. That's fun. So it's like actual truth, right? Like, yeah. Here's the raw data. Deal with it.
Yeah, exactly that. You know, whether or not they choose to use the data and actually implement change is a different story altogether. You never quite know with a public sector organization what happens, because there's quite a bit of red tape. There are different stakeholders involved. So if it goes up the chain, it goes up the chain. If it's not used, it's not used.
Do you ever give people data that they don't like? They're like, no, that must be wrong.
Oh, well, wrong in the sense that it doesn't quite fit their worldview, and they're not quite happy with the findings. That happens all the time. They think they'd get something, but they get the opposite. And they're typically not very happy with me or with the findings themselves, but hey, that's what it is. It's the world we live in. You're not always going to get what you want.
This is true. Okay. So what do you teach at Cambridge then? Do you teach data science?
Yeah. In a matter of speaking. So I teach a bit of statistics with policing students here. They typically come for a master's of policing, and I typically work with them. I have a number of students that I work with as well, but I'm mainly in the statistics stream, you know, dealing with large data sets and how to navigate your way through it.
Cool. Okay. I had to take statistics in university.
Did you like
it? I'm not sure I really, it's hard to say yes and no. I think it was second year. So it was undergrad statistics, first or second year. And I was quite ill. So I wasn't really going to class, and I think I got a D on everything. Like I just didn't go. And then I nailed the final exam and was like, I should have just learned everything first instead of last. I would have ended up with a higher grade. So yeah, I think I did enjoy it,
yeah.
But it's not like a humanities course.
Yeah. I think that statistics is something that should be taught to high schoolers right from the very beginning. I think that it offers a lot of knowledge that is very practical. So mathematics is one thing, right? Learning algebra in math class is one thing, but being able to calculate a standard deviation or an average helps you to interpret the world better. Like you're just able to look at certain phenomena and say, well, is this an outlier or is this an average? And how do I orient myself within that? And you know, in other words, it helps you make better sense of the world around you.
Did you hear, I don't know if you've heard, but dad's been starting up Peterson Academy. It's launching in the fall.
Yeah.
Has anyone been telling you have? You should come teach a course if you were interested on statistics.
I'd love to make
statistics cool.
I can. I've been told that I'm not a bad statistics teacher because I think that you have to get away from the math and try to ground it within very practical examples.
Yeah.
And I think people gravitate to it if they find that there's a practical purpose or use to statistics.
Okay, cool. Well, we won't talk about that now. We'll be in touch about that.
Well, I appreciate the invite. I'd love to do it.
Okay, sweet. That's fun. Great. Okay. I'm going to have some questions about just things people might find interesting. Might have to do with statistics. We'll see. You also have been writing about modern dating, no?
Mm-hmm.
So how does that get intertwined into statistics and law?
It's a good question. I get that question a lot. Like what is a data scientist doing? Why is he using all these mathematical models to try to understand dating? And I think the simple answer to that is that, well, I'm just interested in the phenomenon, right? I've been on dates and I've dated myself. So why not actually try to understand it in a more statistical way? Or a more empirical way. And there's a lot of data out there to work with. So I think that being able to apply statistical principles, data science to something like this helps people understand a very complex phenomenon. All I'm doing is simplifying something that's very complex. And I think it gives people insight about how things operate.
All I'm doing is simplifying something very complex.
Oh, yeah.
The dating world, relationships. Yeah. Okay. Okay. In that case, I've got some very specific questions.
All right, shoot.
So, okay, let's do it. What do you think happens in a relationship when the woman out-earns what the man earns?
It's going to end in divorce more than likely. So there's a study conducted, by American psychologists, and they found that if a woman out-earned her husband, it was 50% likely that the marriage would end in divorce. In fact, this was corroborated by studies done by Finnish data scientists or Finnish psychologists, as well as Swedish psychologists. And it's interesting because the Swedish psychologist found that if a woman brought in 80% of the total household income, there was the likelihood of divorce increased by a factor of two relative to if a woman brought in, let's say, 20% of the total household income.
Wow. Okay. So you said, so don't all relationships have a 50% chance of ending in divorce?
Yeah, that's what everyone says, or at least that's the idea out there. I don't know how well that statistic is stress tested because I think it's contingent on a lot of factors. So economics is a big one. During periods of depression, people or economic downturn, people typically don't get divorced. They typically stick together because it's very costly. And as well, you know, there's a lot of mediating factors that allow a divorce to happen or make it more likely to happen. But economics is a massive factor, specifically economics, as in the wife making more than the husband.
So what's the solution there?
I don't think there is a solution. I think that people should probably lower their expectations and in terms of understanding that, okay, well, this person is the breadwinner and it's probably, whether or not it's a man or the woman, that person is the breadwinner. It's just, it's how the situation is. And one should probably temper their expectations about that.
Okay. That makes sense. Are there tricks that you've heard of that you can do to offset that? So if you are the breadwinner in a family and you're the female, is there something you can do to offset the fact? Cause it must have something to do with dominance, right? You don't want to be, maybe you don't want to be the dominant person in the relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it probably goes back to roles played in relationships. It's not always the case that the man is the breadwinner. It's sometimes the case that the woman is more dominant and she is the breadwinner. And so it probably comes down to being able to met out responsibilities on the part of both sexes. And sometimes the man stays home and takes care of children. And sometimes the woman goes out there and earns the money. And so it probably is contingent on both partners understanding that this is the role that is played.
Okay. That makes sense. Or they're just doomed.
Or they're just doomed.
Yeah. Okay. You've talked about dark gentlemen. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? What's a dark gentleman?
So a dark gentleman is a term that I've sort of coined to describe the perfect man, as it were, or the man that is the most attractive. And the dark gentleman is a combination of a man that is able to provide the three P's. So he's able to protect, provide, as in, you know, economic provision and parentally invest. But at the same time, he does have those dark triad characteristics, which makes him very attractive. So he threads the line between the perfect gentleman and that dark triad personality. So he's able to combine those two aspects, which are held in logical contrast. So I refer to it as the unity of contradictions. It's actually very similar to when your dad speaks about chaos and order. I think the point that Jordan is trying to get across here is that you need a combination of the two. You need some sort of golden mean, as it were. You can't have too much order. You can't have too much chaos, because in both situations, you get totalitarianism.
Yeah, that makes sense. So that would be, I feel like the dark triad too. Can you list off what those characteristics are?
Absolutely. So the dark triad are three personality traits that are found in individuals. So you have Machiavellianism, which is typically described as sort of manipulation or the ability to manipulate. The second is narcissism, you know, pretty straightforward. And the third is psychopathy. So callousness, lying, thrill seeking. So it's said by psychologists that these three traits are quite negative. So individuals that possess these traits are dark, right? They're very negative individuals.
Yeah. Okay. And so, but for some reason they're attractive to women.
Yeah, exactly that. So these
dark, but attractive. Yeah, evil, but attractive.
Yeah. Very, very attractive. So these individuals, it's important to keep in mind that they're very low in neuroticism. They're very high in openness. They're very low in conscientiousness. They're very high in extroversion. Mm. And those characteristics on their own are pretty attractive. So a narcissist is, you know, smiles, speaks nicely, wears very nice clothes. You know, that in and of itself is pretty attractive to women, right? A person that is Machiavellian is very disagreeable. And what the statistics indicate is that an individual that is highly disagreeable, if they are below the mean level of disagreeability, they typically make 18.3% more in terms of yearly income. And that translates to about $9,722 per year.
Wow. How much of that is behind the wage gap?
A lot. So I think agreeableness has to do quite a bit with why some women don't advance as far as they do in their fields, in their respective fields. What men are on average more disagreeable than women, so they're more likely to fight for a wage increase. They're more than likely to fight for a promotion. And so this specific factor explains why men typically, out-earn women, on top of the fact that, there's a whole number of factors, including differences in work, in job type occupation, in industry, in schooling, in the amount of hours worked, the level of danger of the job itself. It's one factor among many, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've always been have you ever done my dad's personality test, just out of curiosity?
I have done a personality test, actually. Yes, but not.
You have?
Not quite your dad's.
Which one did you do?
I don't remember, but I do have it saved on my phone. I have the results saved somewhere.
Just from working for my dad and trying to run a business and everything, I've had to kind of force myself into uncomfortable positions. And then you get used to it, right? Asking for more as a woman. Mm. But I think a trick for doing that is the worst thing that can happen. Just to give you my experience of trying to ask for more money or something is I get these feelings of guilt. And of do I deserve it? Am I doing enough? This kind of thing, even if kind of logically I can say, okay, well, this makes sense, but it's this guilt horror feeling for asking for more. Whereas if I talk to disagreeable men, they're okay with asking for more, even if they don't necessarily think they deserve it. They're like, yeah, I'm just going to see what happens. And they're like, well, the worst thing that could happen is they say no.
Yes.
So if you think about it that way, it's what's going to happen if you ask for a raise? They're going to say no. That's not that big a deal. But the feeling inside is angst and horror.
Yes.
I think as a female, maybe at least me sometimes.
Yeah. I think a lot of women do have that specific experience. I think a lot of men are more comfortable asking for a raise. And you're right. It's all a matter of opportunity and just taking risks. I think a lot of the scientific literature would indicate that women are more risk averse than men. Men are typically the ones that, we talk about job type occupation. They're typically the ones that do very dangerous jobs, right? Your dad will speak about, people that work on oil rigs out in, various parts of the world, specifically in Alberta. And that's not a very safe job, right? It's quite dangerous. And yeah. it takes a lot of cojones to do a job like that. You have to be quite interested in risk or very risk oriented, as it were.
Oh yeah, that's for sure. I've got cousins who work on oil rigs. They're crazy. People lose arms on those things. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I've got some more questions from things you've written. Ooh. Okay. Let's talk about this one. This is fun. Why are smart women less likely to get married? People above a certain IQ.
That's a good question. So there was a study. I'll add a bit of context here. So there's a study that was conducted by four universities here in the UK, and it was on marriage and the role played by IQ or how IQ affects marriage. And what the study found was that every 16 point increase in a man's IQ increases his odds of marriage or his likelihood of marriage by 35%. In contrast, every 16 point increase in a woman's IQ decreases her odds of marriage by 40%. So you can see here that there's a staggering imbalance, right?
And
40%, a whopping 40% per a 16 point increase.
Do you know if there've ever been any studies on do men say you get somebody with a 135 IQ as a male, do we know the average IQ they're marrying? They can't be skewing towards 100, right? Wouldn't you just get, honestly, wouldn't there be a communication issue if there's a 2 standard deviation difference in IQ?
Yeah, more than likely. I don't know of any studies that would indicate that, but I think going back to your original question as to why women have an issue, particularly women with a high IQ have an issue getting married, is that they're looking for a person on their same IQ level, their same intellectual level. And it's really hard to find someone with that high of an IQ. And these individuals are typically probably in a lab somewhere or already married. And for men as well, I think a lot of guys have an ego and they want to seem like the smarter one in a relationship, right? They want to seem the most dominant one. And I think they're, they're put upon or they're turned off by a woman that is very smart, right? It's very emasculating.
Yep, that makes sense. Oh, I mean, that makes sense. Fewer people out there and yeah. I mean, I understand that. I don't think I'd want to be with somebody who I thought was dumber than me, honestly. Be more attractive if they're smarter than me. Like, oh, I didn't think of that. That's fun. Instead of being like, I've already thought of that, but thank you.
Yeah.
Well,
I think you need a balance, right? I think you need someone that is able to sort of pick up the slack. So there's certain things that I don't know that I would, you know, I love that my partner knows and the opposite, right? I think it's that balance as well, that you're able to balance one another out. Although I did have a friend and he would always say that he had a very high IQ. It was like 150 or something. He would say to me, where I would ask him, you know, if you dated a girl with 100 IQ, wouldn't there be a communication issue? And I think he said very callously, I have enough intelligence for both of us. And I said, all right, interesting.
Okay. I mean, I can see that too. I think it's probably dependent on personality too. Yeah. I'm sure some people, like maybe your friend was just like, it doesn't matter. Like yeah. I have enough IQ. My brain is good enough for both of us. Yeah, fair. That's good. Okay.
Well, on this point as well, Michaela, I just want to say that it's also down to preferences as well, is that women typically look for men who are much smarter than they are, right? They, you know, in terms of attractiveness, the two greatest predictors of a male attraction, as in females being attracted to males, are educational attainment and income. And that's not the same for males, right? The two characteristics that males typically look for are youth and fertility.
Yes. Harsh, but true. Okay. You said in an article, it's from my list of questions, that there's a disconnect between what women want and what's actually available to them. Mm. Why do you think that is?
It's a good question. And I think it's not just women. I think it's just people in general. There's a level of entitlement that a lot of people have. And what you think you get is not often what you get in reality. So a woman that is highly educated, woman that makes quite a bit of money on a yearly basis, you know, she in her mind and probably rightly so deserves a partner that makes quite a bit of money and has an equal level of education. But the trouble with that is that there are few men who fit that certain category, who fit that criteria, who can reach that certain level. And he is most likely interested in a woman that is much younger. So although, you know, the one feels that she can attain this partner, it's probably not the case that she will be able to do so. So it's that disconnect between reality and perception.
Hmm. I bet you make a lot of people unhappy.
Yeah, I don't know. I think maybe my writing makes people uncomfortable, but I think on a daily basis, I get on pretty well with people sometimes.
Have you gotten any backlash for anything you've written?
Yeah, I got a couple of mean emails. I think one of my friends was very upset with me, but you know, I just had to explain to her that these are just facts. I'm just reporting this stuff, right? I'm not trying to like, can I swear on your podcast?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not trying to shit on you. I'm not trying to ruin your day or anything. This is just what the numbers indicate and it is what it is, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. That sounds like fun. Okay. That sounds like fun. And it's fair. And like reporting statistics too is one thing. It doesn't mean that there aren't going to be outliers. So yeah. People don't have to particularly get offended, right? Because it's like, no, on average, this is life.
Right.
This is what it looks like.
I'm sure you get the same as well, right? I'm sure you talk to groups of people and they're just not happy with what you have to say, but it's just, this is the reality in which we live, right? We can't go left or right.
Yeah. I don't think I get that much. Oh, actually, that's not true. I'm going to bring this up. The most recent thing I think I freaked out about on Instagram was this Leah Thomas swimming situation. And I was like, okay, I don't really care what people do, but that's turning me into a feminist, people. It's turning me into a feminist. And I had one of my friends from Toronto message me and they're like, oh, now you're a swim expert. Mm. I was like, excuse me. So yeah. I don't know. I don't get too much negative attention. Most of it has to do with my dad, I think.
Mm. I can imagine. I think that's a double-edged sword, right? Having a father as famous as Jordan Peterson has its benefits, but of course there's a lot of drawbacks to that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I think in my family, it's different. I think my brother, like the reason he's kind of stayed out of anything he's less extroverted than me. So that's probably the main reason, but also is he doesn't want any of the negativity that comes with it. Cause we did have a kind of chasm with like friends splitting and it was stressful, but I don't care. Obviously I like it. I enjoy it actively. Bring it on, troublemakers.
Good mentality to have.
This episode is brought to you by Paleo Valley, 100% grass-fed beef sticks. I'm in Miami because I'm allergic to Tennessee. Long story. We'll update on the next Q&A. So I don't have beef sticks to show you, but just imagine a pepperoni stick, but beef. These things are delicious, according to my brother and everyone else I've fed one who comes over. They come over, I'm like, you want a beef stick? They take a beef stick. They enjoy the beef stick. They have zero preservatives or fillers. It's just 100% American, 100% grass-fed and finished beef from domestic regenerative farms and organic spices. They're a great and super easy way to lose weight. Just switch whatever snack you're used to for beef sticks. Paleo Valley is unlike any of their competitors. They're committed to making high-quality products free of problematic ingredients and farming practices that harm the environment. Free of those practices. Their products come from small family-owned farms right here in the US, and their cows are never fed grains or antibiotics. Paleo Valley's mission is to create products that live up to their own strict standards and always prioritize health over profit. For example, they always insist on nutrient density in an industry that prioritizes everything else, especially in the US. They also acknowledge every dietary choice and every added ingredient is an opportunity to take care of ourselves. You can help your body and the environment by trying Paleo Valley's high quality protein today. Just head over to paleovalley.com and enter code MP for 15% off your first order. That's paleovalley.com with code MP for 15% off your first order. I hope you're enjoying this episode.
How have dating and the process of mate selection changed, say, in the last 40 years?
That's a good question. So we can take our parents as an example. How did your parents meet?
They grew up next to each other and met when they were 8.
Well, would you look at that? A local dominance hierarchy, right? So they lived next to one another. They probably saw each other every day at school, local bars, that sort of thing. Very much a localized phenomenon. The same thing with my parents, right? They didn't live next door as your parents did, but they live within close proximity. So the modern dating marketplace is very different in the sense that on one hand, we have the globalization of the sexual marketplace and collapse of local status hierarchies in the sense that technologies like Tinder or Instagram make it so that you have more viable partners from which to choose from. I think that is one significant factor. Other factors would include greater variability among males. So we talk about Pareto distributions and power laws. You have more guys that are sort of average or below average, and a very small percentage of men that make a lot of money that are very well to do. And these men that are more desirable for women. And as well, you have a higher level of female attainment. A lot of women are doing better relative to their male counterparts. And so that notion of hypergamy, so women marrying upwards, plays an important role here, where it creates a power law distribution in the dating world, where there's a very small percentage of men that are desired by the outsized proportion of women.
Yeah. Okay. So those are problems, but I don't know how to solve them. How do you feel about the current like red pill kind of group of people?
I think that's a fantastic question. And I actually thought you would ask me that. Personally, I am not a part of that community. I'm not a member of the manosphere or whatever they call it. I'm not a joiner. So I would never join any group. That's just not how I do things. Kind of just a lone wolf. But I would say that there are some positive aspects to it. So I know Rolla Tomasi was on your podcast a little while back, and you know, I've read some of his work, and I don't know him personally, but I can say that he's very thorough in what he writes. And there is a bit of truth to what he does write, I think, at least looking at it from my perspective.
You read The Rational Male?
Yeah. I think that is one of the foundational readings to do if you're looking to write on this topic. In my opinion. But while that...
I have a question about that then.
Sure, sure.
Okay. I was told, and I don't know whether this is true or not, but I was told that there aren't actual statistics or there isn't any information behind the statistics in that book. Is that just wrong? Is that book an accurate representation?
I don't know if that's the case, actually. I remember that a lot of it, because it's been quite a while since I read those books, maybe 4 years ago. I don't recall there being a whole load of statistics. I do remember some, but it's more so logical arguments, or specifically some anecdotal examples were presented.
Okay.
Yes. Cool. But I suppose moving forward with the question that you've asked, I do think that there are some positive aspects to the red pill in terms of, you know, for men bettering oneself and engaging in a positive way when it comes to romantic relationships. But I do think that there are some negative aspects as well, where it does lead men to hate women in some respects, right? It does generate that. And I know there's some YouTube channels that cater to that sort of thing, dunking on women, that sort of Jerry Springer-esque entertainment. So that definitely does play a role within the red pill community, is a hatred of women, instead of looking at men and women as being equal but different and playing specific roles within a relationship. And that one is not complete without the other, and that you need both to have a healthy relationship and create a healthy family.
Yeah, that seems like a positive way of talking about it. I think I pretty much agree with you. Like, I can definitely see benefits of, and I know people who have had benefits from being in the red pill community or listening to those videos where it's like, I was thinking about the world completely wrong, and now I can see it for what it is. But then there are people who are like, oh, now I see it for what it is. Women are evil.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's a fantastic point, because it's just like any bit of knowledge you receive, right? You can go one of two ways with it. You can look at it in a very positive light and say, well, I can use this to improve my life and the lives of those around me, or I could take this knowledge and do a lot of damage with it. And, you know, it's like with the pickup community in the red pill space, is that, are you using it to better your, you know, romantic prospects in the sense of getting in healthy relationships, or are you just looking to get laid? Are you looking to have as much vapid sex as possible?
Yeah, exactly. Couldn't agree more. What's your goal, like, over the next number of years? Like, you're teaching at Cambridge. What's your life plan?
My life plan? That's a good question. You know, I never really talk about myself. I try to keep it specifically to my ideas and to my writing, but just this once, Michaela, just for you.
Okay, good.
I'll speak about my life goals. Very vague and opaque, very abstract. Freedom and apotheosis. So freedom, I want to be as free as possible. I want to do what I want, when I want, with whoever I want. And
nice.
Apotheosis is just reaching the highest possible version, or being the greatest possible version of myself.
Okay, I like it. I feel like that's kind of how I feel. Yeah. Like, I want to do whatever I want. Don't bug me about stuff. Make me do things I don't want to do. Exactly.
I'm not worried with what other people are doing. I'm not big into social media. I'm just really focused on doing my own thing and, you know, living my life one day at a time. And I have my goals, as everyone else does, and I'm going to work towards those things. I'm not really interested in the fanfare or the social media stuff. There's no Instagram stories. There's no tweets. There's no posts on Facebook. It's just me doing my thing.
I'm going to blow one of these clips up, ruin your life. Do you think there's anything that can be done about the current imbalance in the sexual marketplace?
No.
Like, are there things? No, no. That's it.
No, that's just no. I'm sorry to be negative, but this is just how it is. Again, we're talking about reality, as it were. And I think that this sort of phenomenon just plays itself out. Right. We're on a path that is not a recent thing, right? This has been going on since the 1960s with the invention of the birth control pill. And it's metastasized from that. And it's 50, 60 years in the making. And so naturally assuming that there's a solution to this problem is incorrect. It has to play its way out. And I think there is some positive here, or at least a silver lining here, in that if you look at rates of crack cocaine usage in the inner cities in the 1990s, a lot of the reason, or a major reason why young children didn't do crack cocaine, is because they saw the effect that it had on their parents' generation. So I think that successive generations will look at the way the current dating marketplace is structured and say to themselves, well, I don't want that sort of life. And they may just be able to learn from the example set by their predecessors.
I think that makes sense. So do you think there's going to be a resurgence then in more traditional values?
Yeah. I would think so, because when a system, I don't think people are dumb per se. I think that they are underinformed, or they lack knowledge on a specific thing. And if presented with a requisite amount of knowledge, they're able to make the right decision ultimately. And I don't think that's just in the individual level. I think that is at the societal level. And if a lot of people are very much aware of how the dating marketplace is structured and the deleterious effects of it, they're more than likely to restructure the way that they go about engaging with relationships with the people around them.
I completely agree. And that's why freedom of speech is so important too. Because if you just let people have information, like we're smart enough, I'd say on average, smart enough to look at the information and then come to conclusions. If you have all of the information, right? And not just a subset that pushes you in one direction.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Knowledge is incredibly important. And as you pointed out, it's the freedom to have this knowledge accessible and be able to make decisions based off of that knowledge. Whether or not you make a mistake or make the right decision is irrelevant. As long as you're able to make the decision with the information available is all that matters.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. What are your thoughts on OnlyFans?
I think it's a fantastic business model. I really do. Because in one sense, it does capitalize on something which is quite lucrative, and that's emotional connection. A lot of young men out there are not able to get into a relationship for a variety of reasons. Maybe they play too much video games. Maybe they don't really work on themselves. But OnlyFans takes advantage of this particular situation, and it allows women specifically to make quite a bit of money. But of course, there are negative aspects of it, right? Again, it does deal in degeneracy in some ways, right? When one is selling, not quite selling their body, but engaging in behavior that is not necessarily, you know, conducive to building a healthy society, let's say. So while I don't necessarily blame these women for the hustle, I do think that it does represent a wound within society that this sort of industry is very popular. Although, you know, prostitution is the oldest profession, as they say. And while OnlyFans is not prostitution, let's make that clear, it is sort of a derivative.
Yeah. Do you think there's a type of woman that can do that kind of work? Like you said, it's not prostitution, but it's a derivative. Do that kind of work and not have negative consequences later? Just be like, yeah, it was fine. It didn't bug me. And it was something I did when I was younger, maybe. And like,
yeah.
Are there people that can handle that?
Certainly.
Or do you think it leaves a bad imprint, period?
It does. I mean, I think in one sense, I don't know, I can't speak on the psychological aspect of it, the emotional aspect of it, because I don't know that literature well enough. I would assume that it does, but I will say that, you know, the internet is forever. And if an employer is able to look up your internet history and see that you've had an OnlyFans page, maybe they'd be less inclined to give you a job. Maybe.
Hmm. This is true. Yeah. Yeah. That's terrifying. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The internet is forever. That's terrifying. How would you, this is fun. How would you describe what being a simp is for people who don't know what that means?
Ah, okay. That's a good question. So a simp is a transcendent nice guy. He is the type of guy that placates to a woman, that pedestalizes her and engages in you know, undue praise and gives gifts for the sake of receiving emotional connection and sex. So there is no emotional connection. There is no genuine interest in a woman. He's simply doing it because praising her and giving her gifts because he wants something in return. So simp is, I think within modern parlance, it's used to describe a male that is subservient.
Wow. That might've been the best definition of a simp that I've heard.
Thank you.
That was, yeah. I always thought that totally makes sense too. I always thought it was kind of a man who's probably more agreeable and is being nice out of guilt or something, but you think it's just a direct transaction. It's yeah. Do things nice to receive sex, basically.
Yes. It's Machiavellian.
That's creepier.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's Machiavellian nature. And I think the term actually is very related to the sneaky fucker syndrome. So this is used to describe, you know, fish and specific animals in the animal kingdom that are not able to cut it. So they're not able to reproduce with females of that specific species. So they'll look for very sneaky ways to impregnate the species. So male goby fishes, as an example, the ones that are smaller are not able to reproduce, to fertilize eggs. The larger male goby fish are able to do so. So the smaller ones will either hide or disguise themselves as females. And when the males are away, they'll sneakily fertilize the eggs.
That's hilarious. That's hilarious. How does that kind of thing even evolve? It's not like these fish can think, right? They're not like, I better decide I'm a female now.
Yes.
Screw over this big guy.
Yeah. You know, I think you touch on an important point here because I think it's all instinct, and it's not only just in among animals, so goby fish, but also human beings. And there's a natural instinct to reproduce, and you'll look for as many strategies or try as many strategies as you can, and you'll find the one that works best. And maybe simping is that option that a lot of people have. I wouldn't recommend it. I mean, if one applies a bit of game theory, as I've done in a paper, you realize that it's not conducive to being able to have a long-term relationship. You'll probably get played.
Wow. Okay. So there's a couple of questions from that. What do I want to start with? That's scary. So you said, I never actually thought about that kind of behavior of like a simp as Machiavellianist. So you suggested that there's like danger there-ish.
Mm-hmm. In a sense, I think that it is not born out of good intentions, that there's a level of manipulation involved, which I think is the standard definition of what it means to be Machiavellian, is to be manipulative. And so you're not engaging with a woman out of necessarily a love for her that is pure and that is not based on any sort of negativity. It is more so that you're engaging with her in order to receive something in return, which is sex or maybe even emotional connection. So there's no genuine desire for this person beyond a base desire to have sex.
Hmm. This is why I don't trust agreeable men. Makes sense. Okay. You mentioned game theory. So can you describe what that is? I don't know if I'm familiar. I feel like I've heard that and I've never actually delved into it.
Yeah. So game theory is a branch of economics or mathematics that deals with how rational actors engage with one another. So the idea behind game theory is that there's two or three precepts where you have a set of rational actors. They all have a set of strategies. That's the second thing. And the third thing is that you can measure the outcomes of these strategies. So the prisoner's dilemma is one such example of game theory. It's a very popular example of two individuals are, you know, they're on the cusp of being convicted for a murder, and they have one of two options, which is snitch on the other person or remain silent and not snitch. And we can kind of measure the outcome of actions taken by either individuals.
How do you do that?
Well, the two possible options that each individual has is, as I said, snitch or remain silent. And there's a payoff matrix that is attributed to all of these decisions. And the payoff matrix typically involves years in prison. So if both people were to remain silent, you know, you might serve 1 year in prison, both the two of them. If one snitches and the other one doesn't, well, the other one gets off scot-free and the other one goes to prison for, let's say, 10 years. If both snitch on the other, well, both go to prison for 5 years. So you're able to measure the potential outcome of all of these decisions that are made by both actors.
Cool. Okay. I feel like I learned this kind of thing in statistics.
Yeah.
Okay. That's cool. I'll take your Peterson Academy statistics course. Statistics is fascinating. I thought it was fascinating. And then you can read papers, and when it says something like one standard deviation, you're not like, I'll just skim over that.
Yes. Yes. I completely agree. I think there needs to be a base level of knowledge that the average person has on statistics, because it allows them to interrogate data. It allows them to interrogate findings that they hop upon, because I think that there's a lot of chicanery and bullshit that a lot of social scientists engage in when they conduct these studies. It's the primary reason, I think, why we have a replication crisis in the social sciences, is that you have a lot of social scientists that don't do a very thorough job in the way they conduct these statistics. So if the average person were to be able to read these statistics cogently and understand what is being presented and the methods being used, they'd be better able to interrogate the findings and decide for themselves whether or not the findings were accurate or not.
Do you think that's useful also if you're not a nerd? No offense or anything. I'm a nerd too. But I mean, for like the average person, is it still useful if you're just reading mainstream media articles or just anything?
Definitely, definitely. And in fairness, I'm a geek. So I think Chris Wilkinson and I had this really odd discussion about it. And I got a lot of flack from people about being geek or a nerd. We don't have to go over
it. What? What's the difference between a geek and a nerd?
Okay. Well, I...
Sorry, you no, started
it's,
it.
It's okay. It's true. I did start it. So a friend of mine, James Orr, I think you're familiar with James.
Yeah.
His daughter, Honor Orr, wanted to find out whether or not an insult for her brother was the most accurate, but she couldn't decide whether or not he was a dork, a nerd, or a geek. And she's like, you're a math guy. Sit down and figure out the difference between these two things. And, you know, I actually sat down and tried to categorize them in a very particular and accurate way.
It's amazing.
Yeah. So what I did was that I created a hierarchy, and it's based off of requisite characteristics. So a geek is a person that has functional utility and intellectualism. So you can think about a coder, someone like Elon Musk, for example, right? They actually provide a product that people can use, Tesla, for example. And there's a bit of intellectualism involved because, you know, there's some coding, there's some numbers, there's some math, and that's what a geek is. Now, a nerd is a person that has intellectualism but lacks functional utility. So you can think about a person that studies 18th century poetry or like 14th century Russian literature or something. It has no impact upon society at large. Like the average person doesn't benefit from it, but there is that level of intellectual rigor, and a dork has neither. There's no intellectual, you know, rigor or any function utility. And it's not to say that you can be just one or the other. You can fit in all categories. I mean, there's certain things that I like that are entirely nerdy or dorky.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
So then would you assume that most people who do some sort of science are geeks, but in the humanities, are they also geeks or are they
exactly
nerds?
Exactly that. So the benefit of being here? Cambridge is that you run into all these people all the time. And a lot of my friends are in the humanities and I refer to them as nerds, and they say that, oh, you're not a nerd. You do math all day. I'm like, yeah, I'm a geek. I'm not saying that I'm better than you guys. I'm just saying that there's a minute difference between what you do and what I do.
Mine is useful and you're a nerd.
Yeah, exactly. I solve crime.
Oh, that's,
you read poetry.
That's hilarious. Okay. So do you actually help solve crime?
Well, I just help provide insight, and I train law enforcement. I train analysts and police officers. So at some point down the line, yeah, I would say so, that I help to equip individuals with methods that they can use to help solve crime or help police organizations allocate resources better.
Wow. That's pretty cool. How long have you been doing this for? Is this new?
Yeah, about a year and a half. I mean, I'm fresh out of a PhD, so I've been doing this. It's my job.
So you graduated from Cambridge and then immediately started teaching?
Yeah.
Wow. That's pretty impressive.
Thanks.
What do you think men want in a woman?
What men want in a woman? That's a fantastic question.
That is vague, but go for it.
It's a great question, because I was actually thinking of writing it's probably not going to happen anymore, but I was thinking of writing a two-part series on what women want and what men want. So two distinct papers. And I think, again, going back to what men want, I think youth and fertility are two big things. But I think at a very base level, men want affection. They want to be loved and they want to be respected. I think that's what they're looking for in relationships. I mean, you know, there's a number of other things that I think are important. I think loyalty is incredibly important as well. I think men are also looking for a level of femininity. They're looking for value compatibility, having the same sort of values and beliefs. Collegiality, I think, is a big one as well, whether or not you get along with your partner. But again, these are general things that I don't think they're necessarily about what men want specifically. I think both genders or both sexes would look for that in the opposite sex.
What do you think women want?
What do I think women want?
That was going to be part of the paper, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, hypergamy is a big part of it, right? A woman wants a man that makes X amount of dollars, is tall, is socially calibrated, has a good social network. But those are all sort of physical things, right? They're all very tangible. But at the same time, she's just really looking for protection and safety. I think loyalty is a big part of it as well. Trust, affection, that sort of thing. We're all animals at the end of the day. And although we are different sexes in that sense, we are all after the same sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that's important for people to remember too, because there's a lot of talk, I know, in the more like probably more conservative circles, like the differences and everything. And then in more liberal circles, it's like, it's the same.
Yeah.
But
yeah. What would you say though? You know, if I were to ask you, what do you think men are after?
Oh man, I don't know. Okay. Just like from my experience and like having male friends and talking to people, I don't think you're off by like respect for sure. You don't want to be with somebody who doesn't respect you. So then there's no attraction there, right? Mm-hmm. So respect. And then I would say most people want love and affection. like life is pretty hard to do by yourself. Even if I think even for people who don't have a hard life, it still kind of sucks to do by yourself. So you're looking for love and affection, and that probably comes more for men with respect. I'd probably put those three. And then for women, I think you're probably right about that too. Feeling safe is a big one. As soon as you don't feel safe, it's like, I suppose you can carry that on for a while because it can be exciting.
Yes.
A little bit, but I mean, that's not long-term. Like you want to feel safe, but not bored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's safety and security. And those aren't necessarily the same things, right? Safety is more of a physical thing and security may be an economic thing. And it could also be an emotional thing as well, where you feel safe being with this person in the sense that you can tell them anything.
Yeah. Do you think that goes for men too? Do men care about that as much? Like, I think too, because women are probably more prone to negative emotion, you know, on average and more agreeable, that if you get a negative response from someone, if you're like, oh, this is something I did, or this is how I feel, and then you get a negative response from that, I know my reaction is to be like, maybe I should just avoid that topic. And I'm pretty disagreeable for a woman, and I still get, I mean, so maybe that's just how people react.
Yeah. I think certainly, at least in my case, I'm more than happy to have a difficult conversation. I'm more than happy to rip the Band-Aid off and just talk about something, despite it being very uncomfortable. I think that's important in relationship, regardless of whether or not it's romantic. You have to be able to communicate and have very difficult conversations. I think regardless of whether or not you're a man or a woman, it's just a good quality to have in a relationship.
Yeah, I completely agree. But I know as a woman, it's easier if your partner doesn't freak out.
Yeah.
Like if you're like, this is a problem, and they go, ah, then you're like, whoa, okay. Maybe that's a touchy subject. That's a little scary. So yeah, I think that's just good to have in a relationship is, hey, can we talk about things under the assumption that we're going to both work on fixing them rather than being mad at each other and just sort through them so we don't have to deal with this forever?
Definitely. I think a good question here, and I wonder what you think, is that what are some of the things that you would say are characteristics that would define a healthy relationship or things to have?
Characteristics to define a healthy relationship. Well, like I said, I think feeling safe is important, especially for the woman. And I think if you feel safe, you're more likely to bring up difficult topics. Mm-hmm. So you're like, this is what's bugging me, or I think we need to work on this. If you feel safe, then you can bring those up. But if you don't feel safe, you're not going to be able to bring those up.
Right.
And then honesty, for sure. Like, I think one of the difficulties I've had with relationships is not saying things that need to be said. Mm. And especially when I was it's different. I'm 30 now. So it's just different now, but like 22 or something. Mm. If I didn't talk about something that was going on, I kind of thought it might go away.
Right.
And that's having my dad as my dad telling me from when I was a kid, being like, you have to say things, you have to tell the truth.
Yeah.
But I was like, well, if I don't say something, is that lying? Like, not really, but it turns out it doesn't go away. Right.
True.
So yeah, it's tricky. What do you think?
Yeah. I would say that communication, we discussed that, I think is a very important element. You have to be able to communicate with your partner. I would say that kindness is incredibly important. I see this in a lot of relationships where people are just not kind to their partner. I don't understand it, because your dad actually speaks about this, where he says that kindness is important because you don't want to put the other person down, because it creates an imbalance in the relationship where this person is looking to get back at you and you've devalued that person. So you're in a relationship with a person that is now lowered because of your actions. So kindness is incredibly important. I would say that space is important as well. I think you are, you're one unit, but you're also individuals, and it's important to be able to do your own thing and have space and not have to be totally reliant on the other individual and just be clingy. And finally, I would say presence is also important as well. You'll go to, I'll go to restaurants and I'll see couples with one another, and one person is on their phone or both people are on their phone. They're not engaging with one another. And I think that it's just important to be with the person and be completely present when you're there.
Okay. That was more succinct than my version. For kindness too, I think there's probably usually some problems behind there. Like if you're being mean, why would you be mean to someone that you're with, yeah, right? And if you're trying to bring up a sensitive topic, like, yeah, be nice about it. Mm-hmm. That's reasonable. Mm-hmm. Be kind.
Yeah. Yeah. Be kind. I think it's no one likes a dick, right? Just in general, just don't be a dick to people and people will return in kind.
Yeah. And you mentioned space. So do you remember with your personality test, did you come off as, you must be fairly disagreeable.
Oh my God. Yeah. I scored pretty low on agreeable.
Okay. I feel like I can just hear that in your voice. That's good. I get along with disagreeable people. I feel like you can trust not to like denigrate agreeable people but I feel like you can trust disagreeable people.
Yeah.
Because if you remove the emotions, then they're just going to tell you what the truth is rather than lying.
Very true. Very true. I think you're right about that. So agreeable people, they go along to get along, and they're the type of people that tell you what you want to hear as opposed to what you need to hear. Because they'd rather not rock the boat, right? Again, they're completely agreeable. And a disagreeable person doesn't give a shit. Just tell you how it is.
And yeah.
I'd rather have friends that would tell me what I needed to hear as opposed to what I wanted to hear. And I think that is incredibly important.
I bet though, I know when I was, I used to have really severe depression and I was on medication and everything. And when I was like that, when I was depressed, it was way harder. Like to hear things that hurt my feelings. And also interestingly, I was very concerned about hurting other people's feelings. So that was when, like I said, I was younger and I was like, maybe I shouldn't talk about this because I don't know if it's going to hurt the other person's feelings.
Yes.
Right. And it bothered me, like actively physically made me anxious hurting somebody else's feelings. And now that I'm healthier, and I, like I said, I don't mean to denigrate agreeable people, but now that I'm healthier, I don't have an emotional reaction to necessarily telling somebody the truth, even if it hurts their feelings. Like, yeah, you don't go out of your way, right? Be kind, but it doesn't, like, I don't have the angst associated with it like I used to.
Yes. Yes. And you're right. So I would say that it's also a matter of how you say things, because being disagreeable could be you conveying a truth, but how you convey that truth also matters. So instead of telling your friend, dude, you fucking suck, you're horrible, you can instead say, you're not quite doing this correct. Have you thought about doing it this way? So it's yeah, how you present the idea that matters just as much as what the idea is.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I should probably bring that up to some of my more disagreeable friends too, because I have some people and they're so disagreeable that they're like, who cares? Right. They're literally at the point where they're like, well, it's the truth. So who cares? Why are you hurt? It's the truth. And it's like, you didn't have to just slap them with it.
Right. Right. You're not going to win a political campaign just on facts and logic alone. You're going to have to be able to show some heart, right? It's about hearts and minds.
Yeah, definitely. And you mentioned space too. I'm so extroverted. Like, and that's not even agreeable, because like I said, I'm not particularly agreeable, but I'm so extroverted that I don't want to be by myself at all. Like, yes, the reason I started the entire podcast was because I was like, stuck at home in Canada during lockdown. And I was like, I need to talk to people. Like, right. I can't do this.
Right.
I can't be like by myself. But I feel like when I'm in a good relationship, I'm currently in a good relationship, thank God, but I don't want to be by myself at all. Mm. And I feel like space doesn't exist for me. I think it's an extroversion thing. I'm like, I could just be doing my own thing, but as long as I'm right next to somebody else.
Right. I like parties where I'm able to leave. Like I'm happy hanging out with people, you know, when I want to, but I need my space. I need to be able to work and do my own thing and just have a bit of headspace. So I would say that, you know, you need to have a bit of balance with the two, at least from my perspective. I did score very high in terms of extroversion, but at the same time, I am a very private person. You know, I keep things to myself, or at least I have someone that I speak to about those things. And, you know, that's just me. Just prefer a bit of privacy.
I do not, apparently. I was always like that though. I had a roommate in university too. And it was like, she was, I don't know what, but we literally like for a while slept in the same bed. It wasn't a sexual thing, but it was like, you're going to bed in the other room. I'm in the bed in this room and we can't talk to each other. So like,
right.
That seems silly.
Couldn't you just pull up a chair or something?
Yeah. Probably. Yeah. We didn't. So did you say you're not planning on finishing that written piece? I feel like that written piece could be popular. No,
yeah, it probably will be popular. But the thing is that this whole public intellectual stuff, I just do it for fun. I mean, I'm not trying to sell anything to anyone. I'm just doing it out of intellectual curiosity and trying to inform people on something that I think is important and that could potentially be a problem down the line. And the issue with that is that there's a lot of things that I'm working on a daily basis, and time and cognitive capital are the two most important things I think that a person has. And I just don't have the time and cognitive capital to conduct a full scale research project, because I'll be honest with you, it takes weeks to research these projects, these papers. It really is like a academic research paper. And that time spent could be spent helping police organizations reduce crime or helping a student with their thesis. You know, it's all about perspective, but it's just a matter of time and cognitive capital. And it's not infinite in my case.
Interesting. Okay. That makes sense. So you said when you teach statistics, you use real world examples, try and keep things interesting. So mm-hmm. it's not just all math basically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm.
Cool. I'll take that course then. That's all right. Cool. That's good. Okay. Well, I ran through all my questions. Vincent, is there anything else you want to talk about that you think could be interesting?
Well, I am writing a paper. I'm working on a paper on sort of the future of the West based off of dating dynamics. And it was a conversation that I had with Chris Williamson on his podcast about what the possible effect of this imbalance in the sexual marketplace will be. And Chris and I sort of came to the conclusion, or we sort of got to the point where we said that there are going to be significant problems down the line where you have a large number of men who are without a mate. And that does not bode well for a society. If you have a bunch of hapless, listless men that are out there unmotivated, and that has the potential to completely tear society apart. And so I think it's an important idea, an important talking point that we need to be speaking more about as a society.
But you don't think there's a solution?
I don't. I think exactly that. So I don't think that there's a straightforward solution. I think, as I said, it plays its way. It'll play its way through, but at the same time, it's important to be very cognizant of this potential problem, because it still allows you to set up barriers and not potential solutions, but sort of buffer zones, as it were.
Yeah. Do you think it's going to get significantly worse before it starts to right itself significantly?
Significantly. I think this is how a lot of phenomena play themselves out, is that things typically get worse before they get better. Is that I don't think we've reached the zenith of this issue just quite yet. Because if you look in antiquity, there is a 0.71 correlation between a sexual imbalance where there's more men than women, and authoritarian regimes. And it's probably the case that a lot of these men have a tendency of voting for authoritarian regimes, but it's probably the case that the reason why these authoritarian regimes remain intact is because they need to be able to keep these men from committing violence.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. That's cool. Do you think that's why Canada keeps voting for Trudeau?
I'm not sure.
Just kidding.
Not sure.
And maybe nowadays too, authoritarianism looks a little different than it used to.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Okay.
But that's the thing though, is that I'm sure people in the 1930s in Nazi Germany thought the same way, where they said that, you know, it could be just confiscation of houses. It's not quite jackboots. Things can change very quickly in a short period of time, right? Societies. If you read a lot of literature on societal collapse, one of the main things that becomes evident is that civilizations are not permanent, right? They're very fallible. They're very fragile. They're not rigid. They can break apart in a very short period of time over a number of generations. And all that is required is a slow and inexorable decline.
That's so scary. I was just talking to my dad about that too. Cause mm-hmm. I left Canada, right? And like, things are sketchy. Like, they're implementing some laws there that are pretty overreaching. And then this thing with the truckers' bank accounts happened. And it's just like, things are sketchy. And I was like, is this really going to get worse? And my dad made the point. He was like, yeah, well, when Hitler was in power, like, not to do a direct comparison, but things just devolved in like a decade.
Right.
To a crazy point.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, yikes, you'd think that that wouldn't necessarily happen again now that we have that experience to look at. So hopefully it doesn't, but life's pretty weird right now.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And I'd say that, again, you know, going back to the topic of societal collapse, is that I think what becomes clear when you read a lot of this literature is that it's about the maintenance of institutions. So if a society is not able to pass on knowledge of how to maintain institutions from one generation to the next, society is going to fall apart. And so, you know, the Roman Empire, a lot of studies were, or one ethnographic analysis, well, it's not one, but it's quite a large study, looked at pottery in the Roman Empire. And you can see that the decline of the empire was tracked by the sophistication and the amount of pottery that was created by the empire, members of the empire. And the idea here is that they sort of lost the knowledge over time. They didn't have the ability to create really beautiful pieces of art. And I think the same thing applies to other institutions, is that the family, if we want to think about it as an institution, has to remain intact. We have to be able to create new successive generations that are capable of engaging in the family unit. And as far as I can see, we're not able to do that. We're not able to produce children that want to get married when they're older, want to be parents, want to live in a happy and healthy family. And civilizations are built upon the backs of healthy civilizations are built upon the backs of healthy families. And if you don't have healthy families, you don't have a civilization.
Yeah. Well, I hope things reverse.
For why?
Rather than continuing to devolve. You just want to see chaos.
No,
did you say
I don't,
why?
I'm like Harry Sheldon. I don't want to see chaos, but that'll probably be what will happen more than likely. I hope it doesn't happen. I hope I'm wrong. But with the way things are shaping up, I don't necessarily see a bright future per se.
I don't know how I feel about it. I don't feel very good about Canada, that's for sure. Mm. I hope things reverse as well. Oh, well, we will see.
We'll see.
Okay, Vincent, are you anywhere online? Is there anywhere I can direct people to go if they want to follow? Okay, you just exist. Podcast randomly popping up.
I don't really do social media. As I said, there are no Instagram stories. There's no tweets. There's no Facebook posts. I think you got to get.
You're not going to share my Instagram clips?
I'll get my friends to do it. I'll get a rock.
Ah, nice. Okay.
He's pretty popular. He's a smart guy.
Yeah. Great. Did you call James Orr a nerd?
Yeah, he's a nerd. Yeah, I'll say to his face actually all the time, like, you're such a nerd. And he's like, yeah, no, thank you, Keith.
Did you? That's great. Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming on. That was fun.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I really appreciate the invite, Michaela. It was a great conversation. I hope we can do it again.
We will, for sure.